Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, what? Who cares? Marches, they never changed anything.
Bye.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer at the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. Do you sometimes feel sorry for yourself? Sorry for yourself because of many responsibilities, many problems, many unpleasant situations? Don't worry. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Happiness, serenity, even a more satisfying life will come to you in greater degree as the load you carry grows weightier. The natural way to live is under a load. As soon as a baby can walk, he wants to carry something. Ever think of that? Sometimes you may pick up a load too heavy, may get him down, may fall on top of it, but he's happy. Even then, he has something to struggle with. Under your load, you are anchored and growing. You won't drift rudderless. A ship in ballast is an easy prey to winds and waves. A cargo gives her steadiness and aids the ship to safety, helps keep a true course. Likewise, the biggest handicap for a human being is moving through life with no steadying cargo. the young man with responsibilities, will survive in shifting economic seas. Without a load, he's liable to sink. A man with no responsibilities flirts with doom. He'd better pick up a load at once. The workers survive. The shirkers often sink. Abraham Lincoln scaled the magnificent summits of greatness, carrying responsibilities too heavy for most men to bear. But Lincoln's heart and soul grew until they were capable of tremendous understanding. The burdens he carried only broadened his shoulders and deepened his great sympathies and tolerance for fellow men. Under his crushing load, he was yet able to lift up a bleeding nation and carry it to peace and safety. Had no burdens been thrust upon him, the great Lincoln might well have never have attained any greatness at all. Young and old are still lifted up by heavy, useful loads. Those who refuse responsibility may grow fat, but they lose the heights of greatness. They come crashing down to valleys of despair, smashed because they carried no load. A life with no burdens is an empty life, a useless life. But differently, those who disdain burdens during youth and middle age will ultimately bear burdens they never chose, despair, and the crushing burden of loneliness. The loads we try to avoid can often smash us. For responsibilities evaded in youth will come the regrets of old age. So when you next begin to feel sorry for yourself, to feel you bear more than your just share of burdens, stop, think, take inventories, be thankful that God has given you the strength and courage and ability to overcome whatever problem arises to confront you. If you have many responsibilities, you're much more fortunate than the man who has none. Don't waste time envying the other man. He deserves pity, not envy. Do you find life interesting, gratifying? Or are you unhappy because there seem to be many displeasing situations in your life? You don't know how to change them. Has it ever occurred to you that what now brings heartache and disappointment, disillusion, even disgust, may perhaps actually be the growing pains of eventual progress and attainment of what you want in life? Get the habit of looking at what now seems disheartening as unpleasant simply as a growing pain. Suddenly things won't appear nearly so difficult. It's amazing. Obstacles can be turned into opportunity. Tremendous opportunity for growth and for happiness. Don't you remember your growing pains of childhood? Don't you remember that finally someone told you those pains in the legs meant you were getting bigger? Yes. And you were. At that time, wasn't the objective of getting bigger your heartest desire? Remember how all at once then the growing pains stopped? And they did. That's part of life, too. Why must we take the growing pains of adult life so much more seriously than those of childhood? There's no reason for it. After all, if we take the attitude that we are stronger than any problem, that any situation contains its solution, it's tremendous the effect it does. Our whole life is changed. Yes, the way to grow toward the light is like When Nature Wants a Man by Angela Morgan. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man. When nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part. When she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise. Watch her method, watch her ways. How she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects. How she hammers him and hurts him. And with mighty blows converts him into trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, and he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks, when his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, and with every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Yes, nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man, wake a man, When nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill, and she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole, with what cunning she prepares him, how she goads, never spares him, how she whets him and frets him, and in poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget, bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned, though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man and fame a man and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him, so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets the challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls a mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says. Watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind, could we understand her mind. Fools are they who call her blind. When his feet are torn and bleeding, and his highest powers speeding, blazing newer paths and fine. Yes, when the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation? Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. Yes, let me repeat some of this poem, which shows so clearly how important are the loads we bear, how necessary to the growth of our soul. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man, when nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part, when she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise, watch her method, watch her ways, how she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects, how she hammers him and hurts him, and with mighty blows converts him to trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks. When his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, as every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man and wake a man, when nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill, she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole, with what cunning she prepares him, how she goads and never spares him, how she whets him and frets him, and poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she secretly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget. Bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned, though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man and fame a man and tame a man, When nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets a challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls the mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says. Watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind, could we understand her mind. Fools are they who call her blind, when his feet are torn and bleeding, yet his highest power's speeding, blazing newer paths and finer. When the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation. Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. And every one of us is that man. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow, friends, for another message of hope with Richard Eaton. This is UBC, the United Broadcasting Company.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. Workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here, but the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time.
This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at UPA in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of UPA's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not UPA. To slash costs and stay competitive, UPA builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock. Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day. When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. UPA started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but UPA wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. UPA's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. He finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiamen, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly line. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work. And there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xingming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xingming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin. And Li needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Li expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year.
His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasoning that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all.
Thank you.
Now in his second year on the job, Yashin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenants' rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories. A place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle, a company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands, and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yupa's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yupa's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yupa has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yupa's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yupa must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yupa's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in Yupa's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yupa's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
电源管理系统这个部分，我们花了很大的一个时间的一个。
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, Yupa's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. It will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yupa designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the Factory of the World.
Hi folks, in this video I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat, takes a lot less money to cool, it's a lot easier to clean, it's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now I want to repeat. I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, and you can do this at an age, at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
All right, guys, welcome back. EYL, Hometown Heroes Edition, Chicago.
Chi-town, what's going on now?
Shout out to the Chi, shout out to the West Side, to the South Side, North Side, East Side, every side.
We was out of the South right now.
Yeah, we in South Side right now, for sure.
Again,
for sure.
Again.
For sure. What area are we at specifically?
So this, we in Washington Park.
Washington Park, shout out to Washington Park.
Those sure. Gonna know, y'all know.
Yeah. So we got a very special edition today. But before we start, we got some housekeeping items we want to make you guys aware of. It's not too late to register for our workshop, our first ever workshop on 10/17. So as we said before, every single month we're gonna be having a workshop in person, but also live stream for anybody anywhere in the world. And there's going to be a different EYL guest is going to speak about their area of expertise. So the first one is with our guy, MG, the mortgage guy. And it's going
to
be about financing your first real estate deal, real estate financing for your first deal. So you go to our website, earnyourleisure.com, on the events tab, and you can register. As I said, you can do in person in New York City, but you can also live stream it and you can watch it. You don't have to actually watch it while it's going on with the live stream. Like once you have it, you can watch it whenever you, so if you're at work or whenever. So make sure you do that. So, yes. All right. So now we have a very special episode. I'm actually interested because this is something that I don't know anything about.
Zero.
I'm going to educate myself on this. So Byron and Shanice, dynamic couple that also are business partners as well. So congratulations, first and foremost.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So you guys, all right, you're in the mobile home industry, right? So for anybody that's not familiar with that, that is home on wheels pretty much, right? It's interesting because I met you at the event, our networking event. It was amazing, by the way. And I was
thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Thank y'all for having me.
And you was telling me about it, and you know, I was thinking, like, this is just an interesting thing. Because we talk about real estate a lot, but we've never spoken or covered mobile homes. And you was actually educating me, because a lot of people, especially where we're from in the Northeast, we have derogatory, which I learned was a derogatory
name. We shall not say.
Yeah, which is, we used to call it a trailer home or in trailer park, but it's not called, it shouldn't be called trailer park or trailer home. It's a mobile home and a mobile park. Mm-hmm. But long story short, you can actually invest in these properties, and it's just like real estate. You can make money, you can wholesale, you can flip, you can fix up, and it's really interesting. It's a lot less as far as how much money you have to put into it.
Yeah.
It's a lot kind of easier, finance and all that kind of stuff. So, all right, before we even get into the details, can you tell your story of how you got into the industry?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Okay. So basically I've been trying to do real estate for 4 or 5 years, right? And when I tell you, like, capital, credit, I was having a lot of issues with that. And so, man, March 3rd of 2017, that was the day I was fired from work.
It's a great day.
Yeah, great day.
it's my birthday.
What kind of job did you have?
So I was in the transportation industry. I was a driver manager.
Okay.
And so, man, for that time, I'm like, man, how am I still getting real estate? So, man, I was in a life coaching program at that time to become a life coach.
Mm-hmm.
So I will say that helped me up to be where I'm at now. And that's something I hustled. Like, I'm just trying to get into it. And at the time, man, I was driving Lyft to pay the bills, and I was always listening to podcasts. And this particular day, I happened to find a podcast. It was on mobile homes. But mind you, I'm driving, and people are like, man, turn that off, man. I ain't trying to hit that. I'm like, come on, man. So I sent it to her. I sent it to Sharnice, like, hey, take a listen to this, man. I think this is going to be special. Send it to her, and then
Yeah, so he sent me that podcast, and that podcast is on mobile homes. And I always tell Byron, the biggest thing that I learned from that podcast that so happens to be on mobile home investing, like he said, and the biggest thing that I learned from that podcast was you can literally get started with very minimum capital. Credit does not have to be good. And those are the two things that I feel like at the time, because me and Byron were new investors, those were the things that were kind of holding us back. So once I heard that, I was like, okay, we need to get into this niche of mobile homes. So I came home, I told Byron, like, look, we about to get into these mobile homes. Like, I know we trying to get these three flats right now here in Chicago. We were trying to get buildings at the time, but like I said, our capital, our credit was not so good. So I was like, look, let's try something different. Let's go outside the box and let's conquer this. And, man, it's been history ever since.
Oh, that's amazing. I mean, especially as a couple doing it.
Yeah.
Y'all supporting each other, which we don't see. Like, this is the first couple that we've seen on our podcast. What did it take to have a belief in each other? Did y'all always trust each other? Like, how did that develop?
Man, dope question. So the biggest thing for myself going through that journey, I learned a lot. I took a lot of L's, went broke, messed up my credit, car repo, like all the worst, right? And so she had my back. She was the one person that out of everything from family, friends that had my back. So it was like, yo, with this knowledge, like, I have nothing but trust, and I'm going to have so much patience in this. Mm-hmm. And she trusted me. And I was to see her growth, and she just dug and became a student, literally with no entrepreneur experience at all. And I'm just looking like, yo, she a rock star.
I gotta
ride her. Exactly.
So, all right. So, okay. So you listen to the podcast, you sent it to her. What made you say, okay, this is something that we, because you both had lost your jobs, right?
Yes.
So what made you say, okay, this is something that we're going to do full time? And what was your first deal, like, what was the first thing that got you into, like, buying your first mobile home?
Man, so honestly, I had nothing else to lose. Like, I had took so many L's. I'm like, yo, this gotta work. One of these gonna work. So again,
common theme.
Right? So, you know, we got the scavenging, man. We took out a high interest loan for $10K, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and listen, the interest rate on that was 24%.
Wow.
Yeah. Was it like credit card?
No, a loan. Yeah, I call one of them shark loans.
Oh, okay.
Like a payday loan.
Y'all went through like a credit union or something like that?
Lending club.
Okay. Yeah.
And so we got that, and then we just dove in. We started hitting the road. We had did a little education, but we didn't know. Like, we literally learned from the School of Hard Knocks.
Mm-hmm.
So we hit the road. We went all the way down to Cincinnati looking for homes. We didn't know. We were trying to see if we were going to move homes. And, man, our first deal, she actually found this guy and up in, it's called Love's Park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I ended up, again, prospecting via Facebook. I found this guy. He was a park manager. He had a lot of older homes, and he was like, look, we got some homes under $5,000. You should come out and take a look. That was definitely our budget because starting out, we was like, we only want to stay under $5,000. So went out there. We looked at a few homes. We ended up getting two. One home, we paid $3,700. It was move-in ready, so we didn't have to do anything to it, no rehab. It was beautiful. And the second home we purchased for $500. We put a little bit of rehab into it, about $3,200. We ended up flipping those first because, of course, we wanted to go ahead and make some profit so we can continue to invest. So we ended up flipping those. We made $19,500 in less than 30 days.
And then you said, this is it.
Yeah, that's it, right. And that was it, right. That was it.
At that time, you were saying, like, that was already half of your yearly salary, right?
Yeah, so at that time, prior to me getting fired, I worked at the gas company here in Chicago, and my salary gross, I was making about, like, 39. So you thinking about I made about close to $20,000 in less than 30 days. That was eye-opening for me.
Not by gas.
Yeah, right.
That's powerful because a lot of times people are afraid to leave their job. I posted something the other day, like, don't let a fear of losing $50,000 a year could stop you from making $50,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And you could break that down to anything, but, like, your situation is, like, listen, you actually was blessed to get fired or lose your job, however you lost it, because it's like, let's say that you might have stayed in that job making $39,000,
mm-hmm.
and it's like a lot of times people are, like, scared to leave,
mm-hmm.
and you would have never even knew that you could possibly make $20,000 a month.
Yeah.
And then 5 years from now, you could be making $100,000 a month. Like, you know what
exactly.
I mean? So it's
exactly.
crazy. But
yeah,
I like that you guys supported each other
mm-hmm.
and took the leap of faith, because that's extremely important, especially in a relationship. It's
mm-hmm.
you know, you tell your partner you lost your job, and it's like, you better get another one. Yeah. So, like, what made you have faith in him And even like, okay, like, you know, I'm going to support you on being an entrepreneur. You guys are entrepreneurs. Like, I'm going to support you on being an entrepreneur. Like, with no business background, it's not like you guys were entrepreneurs before that. Like, what made you have faith? Because he said you were the only person that really, like, really had faith. So what made you have that faith?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, prior to, you know, Byron's entrepreneurial journey, like, you know, we were already, I guess, quote unquote, talking and dating before we got serious. And at that time, like you said, he had a good job. You know what I'm saying? So once we got back linked up, at that point, he was going through his hardships or whatever. But by that time, we had already built our friendship. We was already best friends. So it's like, as a best friend, why would I turn my back on him? You know what I'm saying? Like, I was there for him through all the hard situations that he went through in his life. And then I feel like he was also there for me because at the time I had just lost my job. I was very stressed out. He was there picking me off the floor, telling me every day, like, Char, come on, like, we about to do this together. Like, I'm thinking about us now, our legacy, generational wealth. Like, he was feeding that into me every single day. It's like I had no choice but to rock with it. Like, you don't get that every day, especially from a partner, from a relationship. Like, that's powerful.
Good man.
Yeah. She got me up here.
It's like a Lifetime movie.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's beautiful. I mean, yeah. I'm a married man, so like, yeah. I can relate to everything that you're saying. Like, having somebody that knows that whatever I do is for us, right?
Yeah.
So like, we are one. So like, the decision that I make or she makes, it's for the betterment of us and our family, right? That legacy. So that's powerful. Shout out to y'all.
Black love. So, all right. So I don't think people fully understand, like I said, especially like we come from New York. And but you actually told me that there's a lot of mobile homes in New York.
Yeah.
But like the New York City area, metropolitan area, and, you know, a lot of listeners that may be from like cities, they don't fully understand how big of an industry mobile parks homes are. Mm-hmm. So I did some research. So it's 22 million Americans live in mobile homes.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, how lucrative is it, like, on the ROI standpoint, how lucrative is the mobile home industry?
Man, well, listen, it's the highest cash-on-cash return of any real estate investing. Like, I didn't believe it at first until, I'm going to give you an example, our average returns are 250% ROI on per deal that we do.
How long does it...
Our normal turnaround is 60 days. Now we're to the point that we flip a house, we flip it in less than 15 days.
Wow.
Okay. So, all right. So, since you said that, can you break down the deal and, like, kind of explain, like, how does that work?
Cool. So, I'm going to break down with a deal. So, we had a deal. We purchased a home for $3,000, right, in Indiana. And the home that it didn't need any work. From an older lady. In most of the situations, right, most people don't really know the value of their homes. And $3,000 said, cool. So what we did was we said, you know what, we're going to open up for seller finance. We're going to help somebody get affordable housing. In that area, the average rent, we normally base it off the average rent, it was $800, right? So we said, okay, we're going to be comparable. Now, in a park, if you're doing mobile home investing in a park, the park has lot rents, just like HOA fees, okay? So you have to pay monthly those. This park was at $372.
So, all right. A lot fee. What's the lot fee?
So it's like an HOA fee. They're paying for the trash. They're paying for the water.
Just to stay on the actual.
Exactly.
So the park owns the land.
The land.
Right.
Yep.
And
so
you own the actual.
You can't just park your mobile home anywhere.
No.
It has to be inside of a license, like a park that has a permit and it's owned. It's like a. Okay.
Right. And so normally like the ones that you drive, like the RVs, those are different, right? You can go take drive those and go into a park and pay like a fee. But normally the ones that you see are kind of just like on actual like land, like those right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You can move those, but it's not costly. Mm-hmm. Normally about $2,000 or so to move them, depending on how many miles.
Okay.
But in this case, so we say, hey, you know, we'll take $428 monthly. Okay. So it was $800. So how it did, we put them on a 60-month term. Because remember, it's a mobile home is pretty much a motor vehicle in most states. It is not actually real estate. It's real property, unless you're putting it on land. So this particular deal, we're getting $800 a month. We're getting cash flowing $428. We put them on a 60-month term. At the end of that 60-month term, that $3,000, we turned to $25,000. Mm-hmm. $25,620.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 700% return on investment we created.
So the rent that you guys were collecting was $400 a month?
$428. Yeah.
And how much did you buy it for?
$3,000.
How? How do you buy something for $3,000 and charge? How much were they were paying $800 a month in rent?
Yes.
How is that possible?
So with that, we so instead of them renting an apartment, right? Because anyway, if they rent an apartment for $800, they got no equity in it. Mm-hmm. So we're providing just equity in that house, right? The thing is, we buy it for so low, right? We don't necessarily have to say, okay, we're going to only sell it for $5,000, right? We still operate, because if you think about the number, it's still a house. It's still a home for them. So at the end of the day, a $25,000 house, where are you still going to get a move-in ready $25,000 house?
So, that's crazy, but I was just like, but if why would somebody not just buy it on their own? If they, like, why would you rent for $800 if it only costs $3,000 to buy?
Yeah. So the thing is, for us being investors, it's almost like we buy an off-market property, mm-hmm. right? The most people don't really know that, hey, I can go get that. And if they do, they definitely take advantage, yeah. right? For example, we have a house Sharnice just sold this week. Mm-hmm. We got the house for $1,500. We sold it to him for $6,000. He's going to move the home, right? We still doing a favor, but then at the same time, when we offer seller finance, we just offer. I usually do anywhere from like $18. I look at an $18 to $25 per square foot.
So you could actually, with your financing, you could have no money and get a home.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I could. Right. So like I go in, I have no money. I'm like, yo, I want to get this home. That's where you come in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm offering, because see, the thing is, most banks don't lend to mobile homes. Like Warren Buffett, he has two lending companies because he understands that. Warren Buffett is in this game. He owns Clayton Homes.
Okay. Warren Buffett lends mobile homes?
Yeah. Yes. So he owns Clayton Homes. That was an acquisition he bought in 1997. Clayton Homes is the largest, like, manufactured home company in the country.
So banks don't give the loans because are they looking at it as an automobile loan? Like, how are they looking at it?
They're looking at it as a depreciating asset.
Yeah.
Whereas for us, we look at it as value.
So it's a depreciating asset because it has wheels and anything that with wheels depreciates, mm-hmm. correct?
Right. Yep. Yep.
So is that true?
Nah, as. At the end of the day, for us, we look at it, we solve an affordable housing crisis, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the biggest thing. Like, cities, we know what, the cost of living is going up, mm-hmm. all right? Wages are still staying the same. So people are getting pushed out. Like, we see it every day, like, where it's gentrification, people can't afford. So for us, it's like, hey, listen, I get it. You've been living in this apartment for the last 5 to 6 years. Why don't you get your own asset, right? Because at the end of this, you can do the same thing. Most people that we educate that buy houses from us, we even teach them, like, hey, this is how you sell your home mm-hmm. to get your money back or make more on your home.
So where are these mobile parks located? In proximity to major cities, right? So we live in the New York tri-state.
Mm-hmm.
How many miles typically would a mobile park be located, right?
Yeah, good mm-hmm. question. So for you guys, I know you guys got one in Staten Island.
Right. Yeah, I think I told you that. Like, I've been in New York. We've been in New York our whole lives. Like, I don't think I've ever been to Staten Island.
Yeah.
Like, shout out to Wu-Tang.
Yeah,
right. And then we got a few students out in New York, and they normally work with parks in Jersey.
Okay.
So they go over to Jersey.
Yeah. And about, honestly, I would say about 60 miles. Mm-hmm. If you're willing to go upstate New York, I'm not sure the exact mileage, but I know you guys have a lot central and upstate New York.
Is there like a mandated distance, like that the federal government will say, like, this is the furthest distance you can go before you create a park?
So here's the thing. In modern day, so mobile home parks, the reason why you don't see a lot of them popping up right now, mm-hmm. because here's the reality, taxes, right? In America, it costs on average like $12,000 to send a kid to school.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you guys an example. I'm about to blow y'all mind real quick. Our taxes on our mobile homes per year, $160. Our taxes on our mobile homes in Indiana, $37.
For the year?
For the year. So you got to think about it. If you have a kid living, if you got children, you got two children, and it costs at least $11,000, $10,000 to send them to school, that city is not eating from that. So cities really don't really like mobile home parks because of the taxes-wise, and most mobile home parks, they're using the city water, they're using the city sewer. So, and you know, in that case, it's like, yo, we're not eating off that. We don't really like this over here.
I pay more in lunch money than that.
All right. Here's a question. You live in a mobile home, right? Mm-hmm. What is plumbing? How does that work?
So everything is above ground. Everything is above ground. So the cool thing is, like, you know, if you need something fixed, they can go under the actual mobile home to repair.
So, but like your actual, like, you go to the bathroom, it goes underneath where does that go?
Is it like a septic tank down there?
Yeah, so normally most parks, okay. So here's the thing, most parks either they're hooked up to city sewer, so they will have the hookup so it can go, you know, along with the city, or they have septic tanks.
Got it.
Okay. So like if it comes from your truck or your mobile home mm-hmm. into like a underground thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, so if the taxes are so low, right, mm-hmm. so what's the, all right, what's the gig? Because it has to be
something's up, right? Something's got to be up. Right?
He's like, what's going on here?
So, all right, the taxes are low. You can buy a home for low. You can sell it for high. So what's in it for the city or for the town to actually house these places? And how come more people aren't doing it?
Good question. So I would say the first question I'm going to answer, you said, why do cities? So most mobile home parks are grandfathered in. A lot of them really popped up in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, began because after the war, the government invested into mobile homes, right? Mm-hmm. After they were using actually old warplanes and using the tin. That's why most mobile homes are kind of like that aluminum. They had a surplus of aluminum, so they like, yo, how can we use this? Boom, we built a house. So that's why mobile homes actually really start going. So in the 70s, once HUD got involved in the 70s, that kind of depreciated, right? The value of mobile homes, because at one point mobile homes were the place to be.
Like, yeah, you told me that. It used to be luxury.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was kind of like suburbia. Most mobile homes are in rural, like suburbia, right? Mm-hmm. If you go to a lot of mobile home parks, they look like little, I guess you can say, suburban neighborhoods. And when HUD got involved, unfortunately, thinking about the next generation, people start moving back to the city. It just kind of took the value down. So it was a need for affordable housing, but with cities, these places were definitely grandfathered in. There's a lot of cities that, for example, let's say an owner actually sells a mobile home park. Sometimes they're like, yo, that's inhabitable. Like they don't, because they don't really want it, because they don't really benefit from the mobile home park.
So when did mobile homes get the bad name of like trailer parks and trailer homes? Like when did that shift? Because you said at first it was luxury, and then it obviously it kind of got tarnished, and people have bad ideas when they think about that. So like at what point did that even like you said, like trailer park trash, stuff like that, like how did that happen?
So to my knowledge, it was an article, I'm not sure the exact year, but I think I know it was like in the late 60s, and somebody had wrote a newspaper article about trailer trash. And that just kind of stuck. The name just kind of stuck. And then, of course, movies play out. You think about horror movies, right? Mm-hmm. 8 Mile.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm telling you, when y'all said mobile homes, the first thing I thought was Ozarks.
Yeah.
Okay, it must be similar to that.
Right, right.
And so the ones they show on television or they depict, I look at, honestly, it's almost like in the hood, right? They depict, like, you know, what they, for example, Chicago, they're going to depict on certain shows that is just the gutter, you know what I mean? Yeah. But at the same time, it's very nice mobile home. It's a luxury. People don't know it. In San Francisco, they have a mobile home park that literally $1 million mobile homes. The same double wide that I can go purchase for $15,000 is going for $1 million in the area in San Francisco.
Yeah, I saw Will Smith that had a mobile home. It was cost like $2 million. It was like a two-story mobile home.
Yeah,
like
he
travels like to movie sets with it.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's dope. All right, so now we got the backstory. So now in the second segment, we're going to go into some details and go over terms and key definitions. All right, so now we're going to go over some key terms, definitions, things of that nature. But before I start, we talked about pricing, but on average, since we're in Illinois, how much does a mobile home cost on average?
So the average price in Illinois, used mobile home, is right at $7,500. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for something new, like if you're getting a brand new home, they can start it right at about like $35,000, $40,000.
All right. Okay. And one of the things, the negative connotations that go with mobile homes is that they're not safe. So one of the questions I had was like, how safe are mobile homes?
Man, I love that question. So so mobile homes are actually, since they're built in factories, they're wind tested. They're built to last, outstand tornadoes and earthquakes and things like that, right? The thing is, unfortunately, like you've seen maybe CNN or so, they may show a mobile home park with like three tops, you know what I'm saying,
right.
Gone. But it's not like, you know, back, I think, what's the movie? Whatever it is. But anyway, with the houses flying all the way around and things like that, no, it's not like that. They actually built safe.
So what's the lifespan, right? So sometimes, like, you know, a traditional brownstone might be built in 1909. What's the lifespan of a mobile home?
Good question. So the older ones, anything that's built after 1990, up to 30 years. The new ones are built to last within 45 to 55 years.
Okay.
So as far as you was explaining that title, right, and it's different from, like, when you buy a home, like a regular home, and you have a deed. So can you explain that process as far as, like, the title? It's a lot. It's just easy to do it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so as far as a mobile home, like a mobile home is considered a motor vehicle. So it's kind of like a car. So when you are selling the asset, you're just going down to the DMV or whatever your motor vehicle department is in your state, and you're just transferring that title.
That's it?
Yeah.
How long does it take?
About 2 weeks to come back.
So the closing, what's a typical closing from buying a home and having it up and running? Like,
yeah, so buy a honestly, it's like a day. I mean, so you buying the home, you of course we're dealing with the park, so we're gonna deal with the park manager. Our buyer has to sign some paperwork with the park. That's about 30 minutes to an hour. That's signing a lease for that lot rent that we talked about earlier. After that, we normally take our buyers, we go to the DMV together, we do that paperwork, transfer the title. That's about, again, a 15-minute process, and then they'll send the title back in the mail. That normally takes about 2 weeks, and then the new buyer will get the title. They'll own the asset now, and then we move on to the next deal.
That was good. Yeah, so one of the things when we were doing some research, it was like there's a difference between modular homes and mm-hmm. manufactured homes. What's mm-hmm. the biggest difference?
So modular homes, more times you see concrete-based where so they have like they are more plotted on cement, right? Whereas a manufactured home is – They're literally sitting on cinder blocks.
Mm.
So that's what you see. It's called skirting. So you'll see some vinyl that's like right around the bottom of that. So that's what covers that up. But the house is actually sitting on cinder blocks.
So, all right, what about insurance? Like insurance for a mobile home, is it different from insurance to a regular home? Is it car insurance since it's actually transportation vehicle? Like, how does that work?
Are we calling Geico? What are we doing? What are we calling?
Yeah, you literally can call Geico, though. Like, you literally can. So when it comes to mobile home insurance, it's very similar to what you would get for homeowners insurance or renters insurance. So you literally can call, like, Geico, State Farm, like your normal insurance companies, and just let them know, like, you would like to get insurance on your mobile home. And the typical cost for that is about, like, $14, $15 a month. So kind of similar to what you would pay for renters insurance.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what's the process? Because you said like the park owns the land, right? But you mm-hmm. own the actual mobile home. Mm-hmm. What's the actual process to getting your mobile home into a park?
All right, so that process, you'll be really looking for a mobile home park owner who's looking for houses. And right now it's like a gold rush, right? Like literally now out of the 44,000 mobile home parks, 4,000 are institutionally owned, meaning like there's corporations that own it. But it's really like the Wild West because they see the opportunity. Cap rates are crazy on these things. So for them, what's happening is you have literally called like bird dog watchers. They're going to other people's parks, right, from another owner. So let's say Rashad has this park, right? Mm-hmm. Now he hires me to come in Troy's park to scout out some of Troy's houses to take back to his park.
They're like recruiting.
Dirty game. Right.
Dirty game.
Man, trust me, bro.
So, like, what's some of the incentives that a park or a lot owner would say live in this lot as opposed to live in that lot?
So the one thing, the cool thing, in the newer mobile home parks, what they're trying to really do is make it a community-based. Because that's one thing about mobile home parks get a bad rap. Mm-hmm. It's a really good community because everybody knows each other, right? Mm-hmm. So like, for example, it may be, you know, the amenities in the park. We got parks that got swimming pools and basketball courts. And
in the mobile home park?
In the park?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
In the park.
Yeah.
It's like a whole
Exactly.
Yeah. And so it's really just the amenities. Like, what can this park provide, right? Like one park, I love it because they give beautification awards for whoever has the best lawn, right? Some parks are pretty much like a concrete jungle or on concrete, but a lot of parks are, I mean, have like huge backyards, gated mm-hmm. fences and garages. And like, you'll be surprised at seeing some of the way this stuff is developed.
So, all right. So you have a mobile home, you put it in the lot, but now the lot has a backyard and all that. So you have to pay for that backyard. Is that part of just the lot fee? Like, how does mm-hmm. that work?
Yep. That's part of your lot fee. I equate it to almost like taxes. Right, because I know here in Chicago, depending on a single family home, you may be paying anywhere from $3,000 to $6,000 on your taxes. Right, I look at it; that's the same as taxes. If you add that number, if you're paying $375 a month, when you look at the yearly, it's pretty much still in line with taxes and some people pay in their cities.
So in real estate, you know, when people have multiple units and multiple assets, they have property managers. In the mobile home game, you have park managers.
Mm-hmm.
Is it similar or what's the difference in those two roles?
So the park manager's role is really to oversee the park, for example, you know, make sure they fill in houses, You know, somebody's not paying their lot rent, make sure they send them their notices. A lot of parks have staff, so they have other handymen on the park. But the cool thing about it is they're not really most parks don't – they do rentals, but they're not, let's just say, like fixing everything in the house, should you say that.
Okay. So, all right. So there's two types of communities, right? There's age-restricted and family communities.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, so all age community would be like, you know, 18 to really all ages. The restricted ones is a more, they're normally 55 and older, so it's more so retirement communities. And you normally see those like down south, Florida, West Coast, like Arizona, California, Las Vegas. Like you'll see the more restricted communities in those areas.
Okay, so how many people, like how many homes are in a typical community?
It varies. It could be anywhere from 30 upwards to 500 homes. It really just depends on that particular park.
And you said that they don't, the park manager doesn't come around to collect rent, right? So what's the process when somebody doesn't pay? Is it the eviction process? Are the deadlines the same as state regulated, or is it faster for mobile homes?
Honestly, from what we see, parks don't play no games.
At all.
Like, I'm going to say this. Like, most parks that we deal with, they give you 10 days.
Okay.
You get a 10-day notice, and then after that, I mean, you can definitely pay, but if you're past that 30 days, they got paperwork already, and they're starting that eviction process.
Wow.
So, all right. What's the maintenance on mobile homes? Is it car maintenance? Is it house maintenance? Is it a combination of both? You have to change your oil? Like, what's the deal with that?
My timing, though, bro.
Right.
So, I mean, literally, like regular house maintenance, right? Mm-hmm. The cool thing about a mobile home, all the materials are much cheaper than a traditional house, right, brick and mortar, because you're dealing with most houses come with, you know, vinyl floors. They're coming with, they say, wallboard instead of drywall. So most of your materials are cheaper. So, like, maintenance, like I tell people, if you're doing a full rehab on a mobile home, let's say a full gut, $12,000.
So – speaking of that, you said fix up. So I took some notes. It's vinyl, it's rail rock, it's foam insulated, cinder block. So like, all right, you're fixing up and you're rebuilding a mobile home, right? Mm-hmm. How does that work? Like, you get a contractor to do that, and like how do you do that? Like, is it just like a regular home or?
So you can. Here's the thing: you can get a contractor, but there's a lot of a lot of mobile homes that use special contractors, right? They just do mobile homes because a lot of the maintenance is a lot of times cheaper, and the materials are cheaper. If I take somebody who has been doing all single family houses rehab, he comes to my mobile home. Trust me, my price is gonna be a little bit higher because of what he's used to, right? but at the same time, we call him handyman. We got like a team of literally five guys, and when we need a rehab, we call them. They go ahead and do it, and the biggest thing for us, like, man, shout out to my guy, Packy Hood Estates, but just like we keep it clean, safe, and functional. That's our biggest thing. And that's his. We actually learned that model from him. Clean, safe, and functional. And longest, that's our biggest thing. Like, we're not coming in there trying to do a bogus job because you have people. Mobile homes don't have inspections really like that.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so it's really like, again, since it's a motor vehicle asset is not as strenuous as a house. Like,
there's no appraisal process.
Exactly.
No, not at all.
Exactly. And that's why for us, it's like, yo, we adding this value because we're not going to let nobody come in and tell us, like, no, wait, this is only worth $4,000. Like, no.
So as far as, like, getting started, right, how much money do you need to get started in the mobile home real estate industry?
I mean, really, we always tell our students, like, little to no money. It really just depends on your market and really just how you're prospecting. You can literally, like, for me and Byron, we don't really touch anything over $5,000. That's the strategy that we have created and stuck with. But even in, like, the higher markets, like, we always say, like, you can wholesale mobile homes. Like, you can still literally go in and still, we call it, like, being that helper in a situation and helping a family to sell their home. And then, again, you going in with no money down, you're just now just marketing the home and then taking the profit off that and then still making sure that they get the amount that they're looking for. So
how does the wholesaling, because I know anybody's not familiar with wholesaling real estate, it's like you're pretty much like the middleman. You never actually own the home, but you can make a profit. It's like if Troy wants to buy a home and you want to, if Troy wants to sell a home, you want to buy a home, and then I can come in and be like the middle person and then make like $10,000 or $15,000 and I don't really do any work. There's no risk. There's no money that I put up anything. Is it the same process for mobile homes?
Yes, exact same process. You know, you can put them on the contract, and the reality of it right now in this market is really no competition. That is why, like, we're in Illinois. We only, like, that we personally, we know of 10 other investors, but we've only met two. And and out of those, and the newer ones are our students.
Wow. So as you're talking, I'm thinking to myself, right, yeah, it's cool to get the mobile home, right? Mm-hmm. But you said that the person that owns the land is the one who makes the profit. How do I go about getting the land? Do I have to buy a lot and then get licensing to have mobile homes on it? Like, what's that process?
So that's dope. So, for example, let's say we get a lot of people like, yo, I got like 30 acres down in Mississippi. Like, can I put homes on it? It's like, yes.
Okay.
Yes, you can. You know, like, honestly, if it's your land, you the biggest thing is, let's say you just got raw land, right? So, yeah, now you're going to have to get septic and you're going to have to get the well system installed.
Okay.
On the high end, that can run you up to like $22,000. On the low end, you get all that installed. I hope you stay under 10. That'll be perfect. But let's say 12.5, right? Yeah. Now, moving the house, depending on where you're moving it from, a lot of moving companies start off right about that 1,000 range, as long as it's under 100 miles, depending on what it is. But let's say on a high end, your move is 5,000, right? Let's say you all in 30,000, right? Now you go get a house. You want to get a brand new house. Now you all in, let's say you got another 40,000, right? You're still under $100,000. So you're still under $100,000, right? And think about this. Now you can become the bank, right? You can either lease that land out forever, or you can just either package that up and now sell the land and the house.
Okay. So for buying it, do you buy it in an LLC, or you just buy it like as a regular person? Like, how do you do that?
So when we started with buying it in our personal, but now we purchase all our homes in LLC.
Why? Just from protection standpoint?
Yes. And then from there, we go ahead and roll them in a trust.
Why? Can you talk about that, the trust?
Yeah, and it's really just keeping your name off out. We don't want people to know how many assets we have. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we just learned from a mentor that, hey, this is just an extra layer of protection for us.
Smart businessman.
That's dope. That's dope. You guys, I saw on your Instagram page, you said one property, you can get one property, I guess, like in the area, well, somewhere, I don't know where in America, but you can get one property for $45,000, and that could generate an income of $800 a month, let's say. Mm-hmm. Well, you can get 9 mobile homes for $45,000, and that generates an income of $2,700 a month.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Profit margins.
Yeah, yeah. So I actually made that post. First lady of mobile homes. But I definitely did that just to kind of show the margins as far as, you know, when we say like mobile homes is the highest cash on cash return on any form of real estate. So in that specific example, I kind of used the numbers that I got from one of my realtor friends who ended up purchasing a property for $45,000. In that situation, she was a landlord. They were renting it out for $8,000. So in that case, again, we always look at long term, the 60-month terms, because we normally put our tenant buyers on seller finance for 60 months. So in that case, if she's making in 5 years, she made a little bit over $45,000, so kind of close to like $48,000 mark. So she made her money back. But I took that same number and I was like, look, let me compare that $45,000 to what you can do in the mobile home game. So with $45,000 in a mobile home game, again, if you're sticking at that $5,000 range that myself and Byron stick to,
nine houses
for $45,000, right? Remember, we talked a little bit about earlier about that seller finance, putting our tenant buyers on payments. Now, if you're putting them on payments for a minimum of $300 a month, mind you, we're no landlords in this situation. So we have no landlord responsibility. We're playing the bank. So in that $300 a month for 9 homes, you're looking at $2,700 a month, again, in cash flow. So you already tripling your cash flow profit. So now let's look at 5 years. How much you looking to make in 5 years? It's like over $160,000. I can't remember. I think it's $162,000. So you've tripled your initial investment investing in mobile homes. So then it's like when people always ask us, like, why do y'all stick to mobile homes? That's why.
Brian? Good job, man. She knows our numbers.
All right, man. Yeah, that was impressive. Whoa. That was impressive. So, yeah, in the next segment, we're going to talk about education, and we're going to talk about scaling and a few other things in the last one. All right, so in the last segment, we're going to talk about education, scaling. But before I start, I just had a quick question. So, all right, there's different ways, traditional real estate, right? You, like, buy and hold and make money off of cash flow, or you can, you know, flip properties, right? So I know right now your main focus is flipping, but is there profit in buying and holding and getting like cash flow from mobile homes as well?
Oh, man, definitely. For example, man, I got to give a shout out to one of our students, Harold, but he's down in Georgia, and he purchased a mobile home for $1,500, put $1,000 into it, and what he did was he saw opportunity with truckers. He understand a lot of guys stay extended stays. So he rented out per room, $500 per room of his mobile home, right? Okay. So think about it. He got his money back in like 3 months. Now he's making all profit. He just created $1,000 cash flow. Well, I'll say this. He paid, I think his lot rent's like $375. Right around that range, but at the same time, you're still bringing in close, you know, over $600 a month just cash flow.
So the lot fee plus the whatever you charge for rent, that's what gives you the total rent price.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep.
So what's your vision to scale? Like what's your plans on scaling for your personal business brand?
And so we definitely want mobile home parks. Mm-hmm. So the larger goal with that is to get an acquisition. Where we find somebody who has a portfolio, 10, 20 mobile home parks that's looking kind of just to retire, right? And just pretty much purchase that portfolio and just build from there and really open up the floodgates for more people to invest in mobile homes.
Is that just something like just being in the industry you'll know, or is it like a database where you can see like these people own this amount of mobile parks?
Right. So we've been doing our homework. We got the top 100 companies that do it. Literally, to be in the top 100, if you own over 15 mobile home parks, you are in the top 100 of the companies.
How much does it cost for a mobile home park?
So now the prices went up. I would say on the average for 50 pads plus, you're looking at about like 1.2, depending on the region, 1.2 mil, 2 million. Really depends on the region, right? I've seen parks that has 100 pads that was going for 1.2 mil.
Pad is just the area that's designated for the...
Exactly.
How much revenue can that bring in on a year?
Wow. So, man, that's a great question. So, for example, I look at it, if you have, let's say you have 200 pads, right? And then you're getting $400 per pad. Normally, for a park to be occupied, fully occupied, you're looking at a good park, 95%, right? 95% of those houses are filled. So if you look at your cash flow, I might pull out the calculator real quick. Troy, I heard you dope with numbers, man.
I'll run them in my head.
I'm trying to think. But the cash flow, I know I had some parks that pretty much, but they're like netting per month in the, you know, in six-figure range, and just net after everything. Mm. So, I mean, literally
after a year, you could probably get your million back.
Oh yeah,
and then $100,000, let's say on the low end, $100,000 a month, you'd be making from that.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and with like maintenance, you gotta have like maintenance, upkeep, and all that stuff.
Maintenance guys, if you have a park manager, that comes with your costs, of course taxes, right? But a lot of times, the thing what I've learned about in a mobile home park, if you give the tenants more responsibility, so they're responsible for water, they're responsible. That's how you cut costs, really.
Also, like the utilities is up to them.
Yes.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So you guys are teaching people how to get into the industry as well, right? How are you doing that?
So, man, we got several products. We got an ebook. We have an e-course. We do group coaching. We do a free live webinar every Wednesday, just to kind of get people acclimated, because that's the biggest thing. Like, we look at it like we wish somebody would have showed us this years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see the opportunity, and it's low competition. Like, literally, I don't care if it's 10,000 people that started tomorrow, it's not going to be saturated.
Right, so y'all are selling people the mistakes that y'all made.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So being that y'all in this industry and it was new to y'all, what are some of the mistakes that you made during your first deal?
Well, I would say one mistake we made being new investors, we was at a park, and the park managers, they had just bought the park as well, so it was new for them too, and they were showing us a house, and, you know, just talking, we actually made the mistake. Well, it actually wasn't we, it was Byron.
Excuse me. I'm
like, no, we got one.
Stick to it. But no, he made the mistake of letting them know how much capital we had, right? So he ended up telling them, like, oh, yeah, we got about $10,000.
Oh, that's on him.
Right. Yeah. So, so, of course, you know, they tried to, finesse us. They tried to finesse us out of a deal, and pretty much was showing us a home that we knew was only worth about maybe